Good evening, everybody. Can I welcome everyone here this evening, and welcome especially our visitor, Professor Ethan Kapstein. Professor Kapstein is Stassen Professor of International Peace at the University of Minnesota, and he is Visiting Professor of Economics and Political Science this year at INSEAD in France, where he is currently undertaking a research project called Responding to Globalization, Social Policy in Emerging Market must be economies. It says policies here. Professor Kapstein has held a number of prominent academic posts at Harvard and on the Council for Foreign Relations, and has served as a consultant to many public and private sector organizations, including the World Bank, OECD, and the UN. He is the author or editor of 11 books. His most recent publication is Hegemony Wired, American Politics and the New Economy, which just came out, I think, a few months ago. There's one book that made a particular impression on me. It was, I think, the first time that we established a kind of intellectual connection, although this is the first time we've actually met, which is called Governing the Global Economy. His 12th book is shortly to appear, and this is called When Markets Fail, Social Policy in Emerging Market Economies. So he's got the dreaded 13th book coming up soon, presumably.
Maybe I've cut enough trees down. Let's stop now.
His topic tonight is Globalization and Democratization, Friends or Foes. Please welcome Ethan Kapstein.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you, Dr. Giddens. I guess I can't resist telling one third way anecdote, if you'll forgive me. My third way anecdote is a couple of years ago, I wrote an article called A Global Third Way. And somehow this article found its way to Argentina. And I was invited to address the annual convention of the Argentine Bankers Association. I was introduced by the then president, Carlos Menem, who introduced me by saying, "Our speaker tonight is going to tell you that there is a third way, and I'm here to tell you he's wrong. There is only my way." At which point he went on for about a half hour promoting the Menem way, and then said, "Okay, our speaker." And I got up and said, "Thank you, President Menem, for the weirdest introduction that I have ever received. So thank you, Dr. Giddens, for a more normal introduction."
Pleased to supply it.
I'm going to be covering a lot of ground over a very short period of time, and I'll try to talk about time. I usually tell time by the sun or stars, but it's a little hard to do in this room, so I'll have to do it by when you start to yawn. But I'll try to keep a close watch on the time and be brief, so we have plenty of opportunity for discussion. Since the end of the Cold War, it's arguable that democratization and globalization have served as the cornerstones of American foreign policy, certainly, and perhaps industrial world foreign policy more generally. And these two, democratization and globalization, have been viewed not only as complementary, but as mutually reinforcing. There is a view that globalization contributes to growth, and growth contributes to democracy. But what if that causal relationship is not so straightforward? What if domestic politics provides the crucial intervening variable between economic performance and political outcomes? That is the issue that I want to address tonight. And I will argue that any convincing explanation of economic performance requires an integrated account of domestic politics. Okay, that's the basic argument that I want to make. My theme, and indeed much of my work, has been informed by a book that I would urge all of you to read, a book written in the very early 1950s by a Harvard political scientist named Louis Hartz. The book is The Liberal Tradition in America. And if you read de Tocqueville and Louis Hartz, you'll understand the United States extremely well. Louis Hartz, writing in the 1950s, and in fact this very similar theme was evoked by Graham Greene in The Quiet American, a book about American involvement in Vietnam written, I believe, in 1956 or 1957. What Louis Hartz said is, the question is not whether America has something to export. The question is whether the United States is exporting the right thing. And surely the answer must be in the negative. What Hartz and Graham Greene argued, I think, in their respective works, is that the United States has never understood the problem of social struggle. Because the United States itself largely escaped social struggle, it did not understand the primacy of social struggle in the politics of other nations. And that, in a sense, very much informs the work that I'm going to discuss with you tonight. The political lesson of economic development is more than a lesson that politics matters. Everyone understands that today. The World Bank, the IMF, everybody says that politics matters. But what does it mean to say that politics matters? In the way that I think about it, it means that individuals are political agents who will attempt to fulfill their aspirations either constitutionally or extra-constitutionally. We must look at the capacities of individuals to act as political agents to achieve their aspirations for themselves and for their families. That's what it means to say that politics matters, the ability of political agents to achieve their goals. And so that is something that I want to address tonight as well. Okay. Well, as this very simple chart shows you, there are really two ways in the academic literature to think about this relationship between openness, economic openness, globalization, what you will, growth, and democracy get left off my chart. That's very interesting. My assistant at INSEAD made a Freudian slip by leaving democracy off the chart. Which must reflect that I'm really living in an economics department, because, you know, economists are very skeptical about the relationship between democracy and growth. Somehow they prefer authoritarian regimes. But maybe you can imagine this going off to democracy, and in a sense it's not bad that it was left off here, because we can think of these as question marks almost. But in the classical literature, we, of course, think that openness promotes growth via two primary channels. First, openness should contribute to greater competition, and competition promotes dynamic growth gains. Or, secondly, through technological innovation, technological progress, which increases productivity, which increases growth. There's another body of couple of other bodies of theory which also suggest how openness can contribute to growth, and we'll talk about all these in a moment. And as I say, there is a lot of literature which relates growth to democracy. So let me first go through this body of work, and then we'll look at the more dismal view of the world. Okay? Well, the happy, what we call peace, love, and dope view of the world is the one that most of us were schooled on in economics and political science, if you're as old as I am. And again, what we learned through our pure trade theory, through the work of people like Mansur Olson, is that, as I say, openness would contribute to growth by breaking up rent-seeking activity, more competition, foreign competition. You break up domestic rent-seeking activity, and that produces growth gains. Or trade and investment bring in technology, and technology increases your capacity for growth. Endogenous growth theory, a more recent body of literature, suggests that trade and investment may promote human capital in a country, and with human capital, you also increase the possibility for technological innovation and for growth. Okay? So these are kind of very well-founded views in economics, almost doctrinal at this point, And if you look at any of the mainstream literature produced, particularly by the international organizations, but by the mainstream academic community, you'll find very little argument, very little contention about this view that openness contributes to economic growth, even though the theoretical underpinnings of that relationship are not as strong as they might be. Even more problematic is the relationship between growth and our missing democracy variable there. I'm sure all of you in this room are familiar with the Lipset hypothesis, one of the most long-standing and durable findings in social science, which is that as countries reach a certain level of per capita income, they're more likely to become democratic. And the Lipset hypothesis, which Lipset himself called the Aristotelian hypothesis, also has very weak theoretical underpinnings. Aristotle and Lipset said that what happens is that as countries become wealthier, they invest more in education, and the more educated a population, the more it demands democracy. Robert Barrow, the Harvard economist who has done so much pioneering work on growth, has said that democracy is a luxury good. So as societies become wealthier, they buy democracy just as they'll buy health and safety standards, environmental standards, labor standards, that kind of thing. These are really arguments rather than theories. We have a very well-developed empirical observation that as countries become richer, they're likely to become democratic. But we don't have a very good theory linking these two, why that occurs. Okay? And in fact, the Barrow hypothesis that democracy is like a luxury good could in fact be turned on its head, because some of you might argue, au contraire, democracy is not a luxury good, it's a necessity for sustained economic growth, for good economic performance. Okay? So really, what's the underlying theory? And he does very little himself to develop this theoretical analysis. Okay? And that's something to keep in mind. Now that's important. It's important that we don't have a very good theory about the relationship between growth and democracy. Because as policymakers, if we're looking to promote democracy, we might well believe that economic growth is one of those universally accepted policy objectives. Everyone in a society can agree on economic growth as a politically desirable outcome. But if we can't really draw this causal connection, how well can we exploit economic performance in the hope of promoting democratization? What if that relationship really doesn't hold? This is why theory is so important, to have good theories, okay? And in fact, there is now a body of evidence, a growing body of evidence, that suggests that globalization may not always bring in its train such desirable economic consequences. There are all kinds of reasons why some undesirable economic outcomes may be associated with economic openness. And one of the outcomes that a large number of economists and political economists have looked at in recent years is growing inequality. Around the world, in both the industrial and developing countries, we have seen a trend toward growing income inequality. And one of the puzzles is, why has this occurred, and does increasing economic openness to contribute to this outcome? And in fact, there are a couple of reasons why that might be the case. And as I say, we'll see in a moment why it's very important that openness might promote inequality, because that may undermine the growth goals that we need in order to achieve the democratic outcome that we desire. Okay? So this economic development of increasing inequality may have some very important political effects. And those are the ones that I am most concerned about here tonight. Okay? Now here again, these distributive effects of openness are something that in general have been put aside in the mainstream economics literature. I think of the famous quote of John Hicks that if measures making for efficiency are to have a fair chance, it is desirable they should be freed from distributive complications as much as possible. But distributive complications are the stuff of political economy. You can't put aside distributive complications in the real world. That's the stuff of politics. That's what it's all about. So this is a very nice theory to articulate, but no one in the real world will subscribe to it. The utilitarianism of a Hicks is completely rejected in the free world. Why should I accept a policy that benefits social welfare but makes me worse off? That, of course, is the question that John Rawls posed, 30 years ago. And so I think this is why distributive complications are becoming so central, once again, to the literature of political economy. Now, there are two fundamental reasons why openness may produce distributive complications, and they're both well known in the economics literature. When I wrote an article back in 1996 talking about this, I was vociferously attacked by some of the leading international economists in the world. And my silly response was, this is stuff that I read in Trade Economics 101 when I was an undergraduate. This is what I was told was supposed to happen. And then the response from these guys was, well, those are only under certain very strong assumptions. So these are the kinds of arguments we've had. The first chain by which openness may promote inequality is the one that we learn in Economics 101, factor price equalization theory, the work of Paul Samuelson, which of course suggests that if countries in the North trade with countries in the South, unskilled workers in the North may find their wages fall as labor-intensive imports from the South enter the North. So that will bring down the wages of the unskilled in the North. And this is one effect that, for example, promotes protectionist responses on the part of unskilled labor in the North in their trading with the South. I must say protectionist responses that have been extremely successful. Extremely successful. And for any of us interested in development here, we should do well when we look at the incidence of tariffication. We find that developing countries tend to be disproportionately hurt by the existing trade regime. This is another topic that we can address in the Q&A period. I've written an article about it. But certainly any theory of distributive justice is completely at odds, or should I say the trading regime that we have is completely at odds with, I think, any mainstream theory of distributive justice. And as I say, protectionism against developing countries and tariff escalation policies remain extreme, largely because of these distributive effects of trade, as we'd expect. More puzzling, however, though, is that we find that income inequality is increasing in developing countries as well. Now, why is this occurring? Well, there's a body of literature that suggests that this is due to the transfer of skill-enhancing technology. As skill-enhancing technology moves from north to south, it rewards workers in the south who have the skills to master it. So those workers see their wages increase, and those who use traditional skills, who come from perhaps less educated backgrounds, find their wages decline. And there is a growing body of evidence that this kind of skill-enhancing technology is having an effect. But in either case, what we find is growing inequality. Both theories posit growing inequality. Okay? Now, the key to resolving this problem of growing inequality, will lie in the ability of the unskilled worker to respond to that changed environment, that change in incentives, in other words, the incentive to develop more skills, and the development of capital markets, which enable, and educational institutions and training programs, which enable unskilled workers to buy the technologies they need to master this technology transfer process, is absolutely critical. Unlike the rich, who are educated, have financial and physical assets and access to capital markets, they're able to exploit the opportunities brought about from liberalization. But the poor are increasingly trapped in low-skill, low-wage jobs. And denied access to education and capital markets, they cannot take advantage of the new opportunities that globalization brings about. So it's no surprise, perhaps, that technology transfer only rewards a certain group in this set of countries. We can talk more about that in a little bit. Now, why is inequality bad for growth? there is an increasing set of work in political economy that makes this connection between inequality and growth, particularly arguing that inequality is bad for growth. But it says this for two incompatible reasons.
Okay. So you need to kind of stay probably within the microphone area.
Okay. Sorry. I'm a New Yorker. I like to wander about, you know. Hard for me to stay still. You should give me one of them.
No, it's just that people at the back might be using you.
I'm sorry. I'll stay still now.
This is inferior British technology.
Right. Okay. That's why I'm trying to shout, you know.
You could move around a bit.
Not too much. Like you're going to draw me a box?
Not so much side to side.
All right. You guys can shout, can't you? You know, you're a very polite audience compared to like the House of Commons or whatever. You know, just start shouting. Can't hear me. All right. Well, inequality is bad for growth for, as I say, two really incompatible reasons. The first is that inequality, there are two bodies of literature that make this connection, but they're distinguishable and, as I say, ultimately incompatible. There is this direct path, which is that in countries with greater income inequality, we see greater levels of instability, political instability, riots, strikes, violence, crime, and this whole set of activities that make people invest less in the economy than they would otherwise. Okay, these potentially destabilizing, potentially threatening sets of activities, strikes, violence, assassination, crime, etc. In that kind of environment, you're less likely to invest than you would otherwise. With less investment, there's less growth. And with less growth, there's less chance for democracy, for either achieving democracy or for sustaining democracy once you have developed it. Okay? So that's one path. Now, note that that path, the notion that inequality leads to instability, suggests that people, political agents who we're concerned about, don't have a constitutional means to project their desires. The constitutional means for them to express their desires, their wishes, do not exist or are fundamentally flawed. And therefore, they use extra constitutional means to express their wishes, desires, fears, what have you. Okay? If you have great inequality and the response is people going out in the streets, it's because the voting booth is not very effective. Okay? However, the second path is, as I say, the completely different, incompatible, but there's also a large literature to support the argument that, in fact, what happens is that inequality leads the median voter to demand redistribution. Okay? If you looked at most emerging markets, you'd find that the median voter is not in the upper income quintiles. They're in the medium or lower income quintiles. So they should vote for redistribution. Well, if you vote for redistribution, you will get less investment and also less growth. Why? It's because of what I call the four C's. What will the rich do in response to calls for redistribution? Four C's. First, they might stage a coup. Second, they might just capture the policy. Third, and this comes from globalization, they might engage in capital flight. Vote with their feet. Fourth, it may be that competition, tax competition, makes it impossible for governments to carry out redistributive policies. So there are four good reasons why this voter demand for redistribution, in fact, cannot be achieved. And if it is achieved, it will provoke less investment and ultimately low growth. So in fact, it's redistribution policy that's the core of the problem. And this is something I want you to hold on to. It's redistribution. The political feasibility or lack thereof of redistributive policy that's really at the core of the problem that I want to address. Now, what people like Professor Danny Roderick of Harvard have argued is that, well, given these problems, what we need are institutions of conflict management. These institutions are social safety nets, These institutions are democratic processes. These institutions are property rights. What we need is to go to countries and drop these institutions by parachute. And then you overcome a lot of the problems. But of course, institutions are not dropped by parachutes. Institutions exist as a reflection of the political economic structure of the society. And that's why I'll say, personally, I find most policy analysis pretty vapid. And I've engaged in a fair bit of it myself. You know, because the assumption is you're going to a policymaker and saying, you know, you're stupid. You know, you should develop social safety nets. You know, and the policy, oh gosh, I'm glad you told me that. I never thought of it. You know? No, this is vapid. And this is going to be one of the key arguments I want to make. And in fact, you know, you see evidence of this every day. I was just reading an article in the Herald Tribune about the problems facing our new Philippine president, Mrs. Arroyo. And this Philippine investment banker is saying, you know, even when our country does well economically, the wealth never flows to the poor people. Mrs. Arroyo said she would make fighting poverty her number one priority. Yet Mr. Estrada also portrayed himself as a champion of the poor, riding that theme to a landslide victory in 1998. But you know, as the investment banker rightly said, even when the country does well, nothing flows to the poor. Now, it's kind of interesting. There was a famous book, some of you may be dimly aware of it, I think written around 1975, called Redistribution with Growth, or Growth with Redistribution. Hollis Chenery wrote it. It was the first book to argue that growth is not enough. We do need some kind of redistributive policies. But Chenery and company realized that it would be very difficult to go and redistribute physical assets, land, capital, in countries. So what we should do is focus on education. Okay? The argument was everybody agrees that education is a public good, and everyone will agree to have their taxes paying for education. Well, we have pretty good evidence now about the incidence of education spending in emerging market economies. Dr. Giddens has mentioned a couple books I'm working on closely with the World Bank, and we have very good data now on the incidence of education spending. And what we find in emerging market economies is that educational spending favors the upper income quintiles. So in countries in Latin America, for example, there is a lot of spending on university education, very little spending on primary education. Okay? In other emerging markets, we find that there is some education spending that helps males, very little that helps females. So half the population, half the human capital, is ultimately left out of the educational policy of the country. Okay? So we find, for a lot of reasons, that educational spending does not really serve as a vehicle for social mobility because of this redistributive problem. Okay? How do you spend it in a way that it gets to the people who are most needy? Okay. Indeed, what generally happens when you propose redistributive policies is that the wealthy quite quickly understand these policies to be contrary to their economic interests. And protecting those interests will motivate them to undertake counteractions to offset the redistributive policy, to block the selection or implementation of that policy. Now, in fact, if we look at the failure of redistribution policy, this should suggest to us that our most important political science model that suggests redistribution, the median voter model, fails fundamentally. The median voter model assumes that the median voter exercises political agency, control over the political agenda. But if we look, in fact, at the economic outcomes in many countries around the world, these outcomes have very little to do with the preferences, what we would assume to be the preferences, of the median voter. Okay? So this suggests that there are severe problems of translating the median voter's desires into public policy. And this is because the wealthy or other groups in society have agenda control. They can control the agenda no matter what the median voter desires, or because of bureaucratic capture. The wealthy can buy off the administration at the cost of social welfare. So in fact, the median voter model really fundamentally fails to explain the kinds of outcomes that we would suggest. Okay. So let me start to kind of wind up here. Where am I going with this argument? Well, if globalization promotes growth and inequality, what's the net political and economic effect? The answer may depend critically on the quality of domestic political institutions, using political in the broadest sense of that term. Access to capital markets, access to educational markets. Let me give you one anecdote. When I was 18 years old, I was admitted into what we in America call an Ivy League college, a private university which was fairly expensive at the time. Nothing compared to what it is today, but even at the time, fairly expensive. I was not from a poor family by any means. I was from a middle-class family, but where that tuition was somewhat out of our reach. I could take my college admission letter, literally go across the street to the bank, show them that college admission letter, and get a state-guaranteed student loan. That is what enabled me to get something my parents didn't have, a college education. That vehicle, that joining of the educational institution, the openness of the educational institution to middle-class people, plus the capital market, the joining of those institutions made it possible for me to engage in social mobility. Of course, I live worse than my parents did, like many Americans, so that's beside the point. Those institutions are unique. Those institutions are more precious than diamonds. We don't find those institutions in very many places. And constructing those sorts of institutions may be absolutely critical to ensuring that openness, even if it does produce inequality, enables people to retool themselves. And that will get the country on the growth path. And not to embarrass him, but my friend here, Nick Barr at LSE, is doing some really important work with the Hungarian government on developing a student loan scheme. And I think Nick would tell you, maybe he will in the Q&A, again, not to put you on the spot or embarrass you, that even in a country which possesses the political will to put into place such a scheme, there are tremendous difficulties associated with it. Okay, so even in countries possessing political will to create these sorts of institutions, there are profound barriers that exist in doing so. So the general argument is that if globalization promotes inequality and no mobility for workers, no mobility for those who are left out, it is much more likely to produce the kinds of backlash effects that will undermine growth and ultimately threaten the sustainability of democratic regimes. And we have seen that around the world already. If globalization is to serve as a vehicle for growth and for democratization, we must somehow put into place the kinds of domestic institutions that enable social mobility to occur. So what is to be done? Well, here I'm going to leave you a little disappointed, because as I have, I think, suggested already in my remarks, one of the things that's really absent from our social science literature are any well-developed theories of institutional or organizational change. How do we affect profound changes in long-standing institutions? For example, if I say to you, we need more redistributive policies in country X, Y, or Z, how do we affect those policies? We really don't know how. And this is, as I say, I think a profound problem. But there are things perhaps that the international community can do, the international institutions. One would be to target much better programs that promote worker mobility, education, the groups that are left out. And by the international community, I'm speaking quite broadly, because here, for example, I think the Roman Catholic Church and the parochial school system may have a very important role to play, especially in emerging market economies, where that school system can serve those who are left out by the incidence of public school spending. Multinational firms might also play a more progressive and positive role in promoting human capital formation within countries. It's very interesting that if we examine, for example, Latin America, over the past decade, FDI has increased, foreign direct investment has increased from $18 billion in 1990 to about $100 billion last year. but we find no more technological innovation in Latin America, no movement in income inequality, no movement in growth rates. And now in Latin America and in the Inter-American Development Bank, we find the leading economists asking about what the effects of this FDI have been. And have policies been developed to promote the kinds of sustained growth that you'd want to get out of this massive flow and now stock of FDI? The bottom line, and I'll conclude with this, is that we must advance our understanding of politically feasible redistributive policy. And indeed, understanding the underlying conditions that are necessary for the promotion of such policies may be the biggest contribution that political economy can make to the democratic project. Thank you very much.
Well, we've got some time for questions. There's a roving mic, I think, somewhere. Yes. So you're going to stay at the lectern. Do you want to choose the people?
Sure. Well, or, you know, you'll go around. What about people up there? Do they get cheated, or do they have a mic? I don't know. Who has a question? It's just...
Mic's not on.
We have really enjoyed the topic, but I think there's still some kind of confusion in my mind, and I want to ask those questions. Would you like to define the key topic, that is democratization and globalization?
Okay, you want me to define democratization? Well, you know, it's what H.L. Mencken said. Democracy is a theory that the common man gets what he wants, good and hard, and deserves it. No, I think democratization is basically the process by which voters increasingly gain control over the political agenda. The fundamental aspect of democracy, to me, is the one person, one vote rule, and that vote is expressive of the desires of the individual. I mean, that's the bottom line. I think there are other attributes of democracy, like equality of opportunity, kinds of Bill of Rights type things, property rights that seem associated with democracy. But the fundamental is, I think, the sovereignty of the voter. What's globalization? I mean, here, for the purposes of this talk, I was simply thinking of it in terms of increasing openness to trade and investment.
Hi. You suggested that in the absence of enabling institutions, openness can actually lead to negative effects on democracy, and that this is something we have seen. Could you just give us a case or a couple of cases in which that would be that would have happened?
Yeah. Good question. I think a number of places where democracy has had trouble taking root would include several of the transition economies. Particularly the stands. If you look at, for example, Uzbekistan, a country that we had great hopes for, there's been backsliding there. I think the Philippines, to some extent, would represent examples of backsliding. You know, Indonesia might, to some degree, you know, in recent times. So, you know, I think we can find cases where democracy, also in Latin America, I think there have been some important recent cases for sure. So I think we can find some empirical examples where we've actually seen this kind of backsliding or the weakness of democratic institutions, let's say. You know, the Philippines might represent some place where there is weakness of democratic institutions rather than a complete rollback of them. So, you know, I think if you go around and look at the various emerging markets, you'll find either the fragility of these institutions, in some cases, rollback, in others, suspension, and certainly a failure to fully implement the kinds of institutions and organizations that we associate with democracy in many, many places. Yeah, sure. And then we'll go upstairs.
One of the images of the last 10 or 15 years has been crowds occupying parliament buildings all over the world, all over the developing world, most recently in Belgrade, mm-hmm. in pursuit of a new ideological mantras of democracy and globalization. And yet, in developed countries, democracies such as Britain and the United States, one has an unprecedented alienation from public institutions, which is most obviously reflecting an unprecedentedly low turnout in elections. Could you attempt, please, to clarify this seeming contradiction paradox?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure it's such a paradox. You know, it could be, for example, and in the United States, by contrast, we had a record voter turnout, certainly for, I think, 40 years. It's the highest voter turnout we had in 40 years in this past election. But I think you're probably right in the trend that you evoke. You know, one could suggest that that's in fact a product of the good economic times of the past decade in many OECD countries, and the fact that voters think that things are going pretty well and haven't felt the need to exercise that kind of vote, you know, and make any kind of radical change, or that the kinds of changes they have of government or of party are adequate to meet their aspirations. Again, I would say, you know, you evoke the Yugoslav example, where you're going to find France is also a case where I think the median voter often feels frustrated by their political agency, and they go out on the streets. I mean, I live there, and every single day, you know, there are strikes. You know, why is this? Because there's no other way for this voter to express their concerns about what's going on. So, I mean, I think even among the OECD countries, we see quite a bit of variance in terms of what, you know, voters are trying to do to express their concerns. As I say, in emerging democracies like Yugoslavia is hoping to become, at present, there is no real constitutional way of expressing your fears and concerns. And I think this is the question. Can we develop the kinds of structures that will enable people to feel that that will happen? Can we go upstairs?
Yeah. I have one comment and one question. You mentioned the weaknesses of theory to challenge these views that economic growth will or per capita income will go straight to democratization. I think it's not only a lack of theory, it's just even reading the empirical world, it's not being done properly. And I will bring three examples that defy this, and I happen to live in these three countries. One is Brazil in those days of economic... In the Brazilian miracle, where you have lots of economic growth but never redistribution, so mm-hmm. and even those days, the stupid military president, he said one thing that was okay, that when numbers go right, the economy goes bad in society, which is true. So the other examples would be Kuwait and United Arab Emirates. They have high per capita income, but they never have proper democratization, and even they invest a lot in education. But what kind of education? Just to produce compliant civil servants and not innovative beings. So I think it's not only a matter that we're failing to produce theories, even to read the word. Okay. So now my question. You mentioned that the variable is domestic democratization. But I wonder for countries in the South that have heavily indebted, even when they may have an economic team that is willing to do something, even though we never allow elect central banks people, so our elections doesn't mean anything. But we have this massive transfer of interest and money from South to North still today, even more. So I think it's not only a matter of democratizing domestic institutions, you have also to have international or transnational institutions that are fully transparent, democratic, and very different from the ones we have now. So it's this egg and chicken thing. How are we going to democratize transnational institutions if we don't have domestic? But how are we going to expect domestics to be if they cannot be in an environment that, for instance, debt forgiveness and all these things? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think your point about the legitimacy of these international institutions is well taken, and it is one reason why people are out on the street. You know, whether or not the agenda of the WTO is made in the interests of global welfare maximization or the interests of Microsoft, you know, are questions that I think most of us, you know, reasonably ask ourselves. And, you know, I fully agree with that, that it's very hard for international institutions to play this role. We assume that they are global social maximizers, but in fact their actions would suggest otherwise. They're captured institutions like anything else. I very much agree with the point. Nick, would you like just to say a couple words about the work here that you're doing while we're here, just for a minute, if I can call upon one of your colleagues who really is doing, I think, the kind of work that has to be done. And I think it's just a great empirical example, since we're asking about what people can do. You know, you're doing it right here at LSE. Something to be proud of.
Well, thank you very much. To be very brief, Hungary wants to join the EU like it wants nothing else. It is clear that to do that, it needs to improve its education system and its higher education system. But the government doesn't have the money to do it out of taxation. So if it can't be public money, it's got to be private money that pays for the expansion of higher education and the improvement of quality. That means exactly the sort of student loan scheme that Ethan was talking about. But the trouble is, if the government lends students money, money doesn't come back for a long time, 20 years. If you want to improve universities now, it means you need a system whereby students can borrow money from private lenders. That's the scheme that several of us from LSE are working on in Hungary. The government hopes to introduce it in September. To pick up another of Ethan's comments, what is scary about it is, one, you've got a government whose politicians have repossessed their country and really are acting more like social welfare maximizers than politicians in any other country I've experienced. So they're really going for it. There's a lot of political will. Secondly, you've got a small, well-defined policy, student loan scheme. Thirdly, you've got an experienced group of people with international experience helping the Hungarian governments to do it. And fourthly, you've got a country with ferocious administrative capacity. This is a country that can do things. In many ways, it's the easiest problem you could think of, and it's incredibly difficult, which is what makes development economics, economic development, so scary, and which is what makes the question that Ethan is asking, the theory of institutional change, how can we get institutional change that works in practice well on the ground, is the critical question. And if anyone here has got the answer, they should write it down and claim their Nobel Prize.
Right. Thanks very much. That's kind. Back there. Yes. Yeah. The question for those who didn't hear, as I understood it, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is whether or not states have the capacity to carry out the kinds of reforms that I've been talking about or that Nick's been talking about, given the trends toward regionalization in much of the world and the growing power of supranational institutions. Is that what you said? A couple of things. First, I think state capacity varies a great deal around the world. And there are some states, as Nick said, in which at least the desire to carry out social welfare programs is greater than in others, which are pretty purely captured by schemes. And I think a lot of it, paradoxically, has to do with the degree of democratic contestation in that state. I've done a lot of work with the World Bank, and in particular, a colleague and I have done some work comparing the transitions in Russia and Poland. Why is it that the Polish transition has been a pretty successful experiment? The transition in Russia has struggled. And in fact, what we argue is that the answer critically depends on the state of civil society entering the transition. Poland enters the transition with a lot of political contestation between the church, Solidarity, the farmers, the pensioners, various organized groups. And that prevents rent-seeking behavior by any single group. In Russia, there's no civil society to counteract the rent-seeking, the robbery, basically. And so in Russia, you have a transition process that's completely robbed and that now lives in Geneva.
And in Poland, you've actually had, thanks to a great deal of political contestation, a state that has carried out a lot of admirable policies. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't tremendous difficulties there. So in a sense, the state capacity is increased by the degree of democratization, is what I would say. Now, having said that, I think that supranational institutions can play a very positive role, and you know, Nick's discussion of Hungary is extremely useful. I think the EU and the effort of states to try and join the EU has been potentially a very powerful influence for reform in economies that can offset some of the gross rent seeking. On the other hand, when you have an EU that devotes 99.5% of its budget to the cap, it's kind of hard to go to countries and say, oh, you know, you guys should get rid of your rent-seeking behavior, you know, since the EU is kind of the model of rent-seeking behavior. So, you know, it's only so far we can take this. I remember, you know, and look, I love the French, and I live in France, married to French, you know. But, you know, I used to love working in transition economies and have French consultants come and talk about the market. And I would say to these French consultants, what do you know about the market? You know, French wouldn't know the market if it struck them in the face, you know. So, you know, I think there's only so far we can go. And that's why, again, I go back to the importance of domestic institutions. I think supranational institutions can play a positive role, an influential role. But if the domestic politics are not promoting these kinds of objectives, more democratization, then it's not such a nice picture. Yeah.
My question.
Well, why don't you speak up and then I'll just repeat it.
My question is also about politically feasible redistributive policies. I think one of the things that makes them unfeasible is that redistribution is often seen as a zero-sum game. I was wondering whether you agree with this. In other words, is the argument for redistribution a purely ethical argument, mm-hmm. or are there sort of long-term efficiency considerations to be taken into account?
Yeah. I hope everyone heard that question, a very nice question, and that is redistribution, you know, the question is that redistribution is generally posed as a zero-sum game, but aren't there perhaps efficiency gains to be had from redistribution? And you know, if we promoted those efficiency gains and an understanding of them, might we not also promote more political support for redistributive? Is that kind of you know what you said? And I think yeah, that's a very very excellent point. There is a large literature in political economy that suggests one can have redistributive policies that benefit economic growth for the simple reason that if you look at the marginal utility of the added income or added investment, you know, we might argue that a poor person or a person in the lower income quintile can make better use of that. I mean, this is an argument that goes back to Keynes, if I recall, in the general theory. And these were the kinds of arguments historically made for redistribution. There are a couple problems, though, that still exist. It still means that you're going to the rich, and the rich, then there's a collective action problem, right? Because the rich would still say, I'd prefer that you redistribute from you than from me, you know? Maybe there's a maybe there's a growing pie, but I want more of the pie. I want a bigger piece. You know, the appetite grows with the eating. And it's very hard to go to Bill Gates and say, aren't you satisfied now? No, the appetite grows with the eating. I think that phrase actually goes back to the British Empire, if I recall, the expansion of the empire. So, you know, we then go back to this political difficulty. How do you get the rich organized in such a way to say to them, this is in your collective interest, and in fact, in T1, in period T1, you'll have more than you do now because of this redistributive measure. And I think establishing, again, the conditions under which that kind of argument can be made is really critical to this project. So I really thank you for bringing that up. Is there anyone upstairs?
I was intrigued when you said early on that the US doesn't understand social struggle. My understanding is that some sections of the US community has understood social struggle and moved to contain it, right since the early years of the early years of this century with the International Workers of the World, really. Mm-hmm. And I'm also aware of Michael Parenti, the socialist scholar, has given a lot of examples of how Hollywood, from which all truth flows, has been very instrumental in keeping out any portrayal of social struggle. It only ever shows individual makes good, mm-hmm. and has kept other movies right out of the scene. I'm also thinking that just in the last couple of days, I've picked up a US alternative newspaper that has shown strikes just all over the place in the US, never reported here. You wouldn't know it was happening, of course. So I'm wondering, when you said that the US doesn't understand social struggle, were you talking about sections of, or that they've never been allowed to understand it, or how did you mean it?
Well, what I mean, and again, you know, let me be confessional. My Weltanschauung on this really is very much drawn from de Tocqueville and Hartz, the kind of American exceptionalism view. And my basic worldview is that countries have foundational myths. And the United States has a foundational myth. The foundational myth is that the critical variable is the individual. It's the individual's effort, success, luck, whatever, that makes or breaks the individual's life chances. That's the foundational myth of the United States, that the opportunities... Well, no, it may not be, but what I'm saying is, you know, the fact is that myths are important. I think that myth has been so powerful that it has enabled the United States. The United States does not think of itself as a country in which social struggle is a fundamental element to its polity. Why? Because people believe that they will be rewarded for their own individual effort. This is the foundational myth. They will not be excluded. And what's very interesting is if you look, for example, at the civil rights movement, what happens is that the minority community is able to use the foundational document, the Constitution, and the courts to advance their claims against the American state or its institutions. This is extremely important. That adds to the myth that if there are inadequacies or inequities in the system, one can redress them through the system. And that's also extremely powerful to the American Weltanschauung, I would argue. I mean, that's my own take on it. And that's why it's so very... And so when Hartz is talking about we're exporting the wrong thing, what he's saying is that we forget how exceptional that is. Maybe it's not very exportable, that idea, that foundational myth. Maybe that's not very exportable. That's what American exceptionalism is all about. Again, de Tocqueville saw it very powerfully in the 1840s, it probably has not changed a great deal. If you do polling of the minority community and you go to the poorest parts of America, there is strong support for the American myth. Incredibly strong support. Something that continues to surprise and amaze people. You know, I do think that's what he was talking about. That's what Graham Greene noticed in The Quiet American, 1956, long before America was in Vietnam. I think it's very, very powerful.
This probably ought to be the last question, if there's one.
You're the boss.
In the light of what you've been saying about redistributive policies the recent speculation that Bush may abolish death duties, do you think, due to the strength of the American institutions, that this will enhance democracy in the USA or not?
Yeah, thank you, sir. The question again was Bush's program to abolish the inheritance tax, what I guess you call death duties. in Britain, and whether that will enhance democracy in the United States. Well, again, I think a very interesting thing, why Americans, the median voter in America, tends to support a lot of these tax cut measures that favor the upper income quintiles is because she believes that she or her children will ultimately get into the upper income quintiles. And that's what enables that kind of policy to find very strong support. You know, where it might not, and again, this is what goes back to the foundational myth, the myth of social mobility. In a society where you don't have that possibility, where you can't imagine your child going to Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge or the equivalent thereof, in a society where that's impossible, this kind of policy one would expect might bring people out in the streets. But in the United States, where even an unemployed worker can hope that their kid will get into an Ivy League school, go down to the bank, get a loan, and become an investment banker, and lay off his or her parent, and enjoy those tax breaks, this gets firm support. That's it?
Yeah,
well, thank you very much.
I was going to say that.